The next case on the court's calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Angelo Umfress. Is that how it's pronounced, Mr. Marvilli?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it is.
We are ready for arguments from counsel. I don't know if each of you has appeared on the Zoom format previously. Our roles are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellant counsel will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Each of you should state your name before presenting your argument so the record is clear as to who is speaking. And please do be mindful of any attempt to interrupt you with questions and of the timekeeping mechanism up in the right or the left-hand corner of the screen. With that, I'll ask counsel for appellant to introduce himself and begin his argument.
Thank you, Judge Larkin. Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the appellant, the State of Minnesota, in this matter. The law empowers a prosecutor to object to a stay of adjudication in a case that the prosecutor, in his discretion, chooses to charge. The district court here simply disagreed with the prosecutor's objection. Disagreement on that objection and disagreement on the disposition in a case is not a reason to find that the prosecutor clearly abused his or her discretion in the charging of a case.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you, because I think that's the crux of the matter, has the case law informed us what constitutes a clear abuse of charging discretion for the purpose of this analysis?
The only example that I'm aware of in the briefing in this case, both at this level and at the district court level, in terms of an appellate court holding that there was, well, actually no, because Kratzer did not have a clear abuse of prosecutorial charging function. That case simply does not include that language. That language was introduced 6 months afterwards when the Minnesota Supreme Court decided FOSS. So in brainstorming ideas of what could constitute a clear abuse of prosecutorial charging function, one idea that came to mind would be if the state were to try to charge Derek Chauvin with third degree murder in light of the Minnesota Supreme Court's recent decision that that is not allowed when you are targeting a specific person in the decision in Knorr. That was one idea I came up with. Otherwise, I really do struggle to think of what could be an example of clear abuse of prosecutorial charging function, simply because the language in both Foss and in Lee talks about that discriminatory intent where you're targeting someone of a certain class or certain race. That's almost like a separate justification for being able to order a stay of adjudication over the prosecutor's objection. So in response to your question, Judge Larkin, I don't believe case law provides us with a concrete example right now.
I'm struggling with this because I agree that the Supreme Court has been clear in stating that the standard is clear abuse of prosecutorial charging discretion. But in all of the cases where stays of adjudication have been reversed, the cases said that the district court judge did not make a finding of clear abuse of charging discretion. But we have that finding here, so it seems that this court has to decide whether or not there has been a clear abuse of charging discretion. I appreciate your example, but it seems to be an example of one in which the evidence would not have been sufficient given the law. Now, that to me sounds like probable cause, and in that circumstance, the remedy is the case is dismissed and not, well, you go forward with prosecution and the defender gets the stay of adjudication. So obviously, charging when there's insufficient evidence is something we wouldn't tolerate, but we already deal with that in another way. I'm just wondering what then the Supreme Court has in mind when it says clear abuse of charging discretion. You have any other examples or can you shed any light on that?
If you ground in on what the district court decided in this case, because you're correct that the district court did make that finding, but that finding was not supported by the evidence in this case in terms of the reasons that the court cited, the district court that is, for finding a clear abuse of the prosecutorial charging function. The district court referenced the mitigating factors and circumstances that are spelled out in the briefing and in the PSI and in the psychosexual evaluation. But obviously under controlling precedent from this court, those cannot constitute the special circumstances that equal the clear abuse of the prosecutorial charging function. The district court also pointed to the lack of criminal record And those same precedential controlling decisions from this court say that that cannot constitute a clear abuse of prosecutorial charging function. The court also, the district court that is, cited lifetime predatory offender registration that the district court erroneously believed Mr. Umphress would face. And as I explain on pages 17 and 18 of my principal brief, the district court simply misread the predatory offender registration statute. And this Mr. Umphress would not be subject to lifetime predatory offender registration for a conviction on his first degree criminal sexual conduct conviction.
Did the district court also state that it was concerned that, given the procedural history of this case, if Mr. Umphress had been charged as a juvenile, he would have had the opportunity for treatment in the juvenile system and would not have faced an adult criminal conviction? Wasn't that part of the district court's reasoning as well?
The district court did cite that, yes. And I mean, the legislature has expressly prohibited what the district court wanted to happen in this case, just because of the nature of the delayed reporting.
And okay, the district court really was. Isn't that where prosecutorial discretion comes into play here? I mean, the legislature has established and set limits on juvenile court jurisdiction, adult jurisdiction, and has said what is supposed to happen in a case such as this, where someone is charged as an adult with a crime committed under the age of 21. So, you know, you're right. The law allows you to charge the case as you did. That's how it's to happen. My question is, when looking at prosecutorial charging discretion, do we limit ourselves to an inquiry as to whether or not the prosecutor complied with the law? Or do we look beyond that to determine whether there was some sort of charging abuse of discretion? In other words, yes, you can do it, but should you have done it in this case, given the circumstances?
With the standard being a clear abuse of the prosecutorial charging function, I believe that the answer is limited to the first of the two options that you just spelled out. And I point this court to some of its language in the Strzok decision from 2010 that Judge Johnson authored, where you stated in a precedential controlling decision, the prosecutor justifiably may choose to charge or not charge a person based on a report of criminal conduct and may choose to pursue or not pursue an alleged offense based on many legitimate factors that are not subject to review by the judiciary. And there are
what I'm struggling with is this. The Supreme Court has said the district court may grant a stay of adjudication over the objection of the prosecutor if there's been a clear abuse of charging discretion. And the state's position seems to be that, well, as long as the state has followed the law, there is evidence supporting the charge, the law allows the charge, there's no abuse of charging discretion. If in fact what you're saying is the only possible abuse of charging discretion is filing charges that shouldn't be charged because the evidence is insufficient or the law doesn't support the charges, is that all that is meant by an abuse of charging discretion, or does it go further than that?
It may be, simply because, as I argued in my brief, Kratzer is no longer good law.
I agree with you. But we still have this statement of clear abuse of prosecutorial charging discretion. I'm trying to drill down into what that potentially means. Is the Supreme Court meaning to say, look, as long as there's evidence supporting the charge, no discrimination in violation of the Constitution and compliance with law, a prosecutor's charging decision is beyond review?
No, I think what the Supreme Court is doing with that language in both Foss and in Lee is leaving open the possibility for something that they have not been presented with yet. And
let me stop you there, because I wonder if this is the case they've not been presented with.
I adamantly disagree that this is the case, Your Honor.
Well, I'm sure you do. I've looked at the case law trying to come up with some way to figure out what they have in mind. I mean, they say it's a power that should be used sparingly. So it seems to me that the Supreme Court has left the door open a little bit. It's not shut the door. So I look to ABA standards that govern prosecutors, because the Supreme Court has said that those standards govern prosecutors in different contexts. And I know that respondent cited some, but one I looked at is a standard that says a prosecutor is not obligated to make all charges which the evidence might support and may, in some circumstances, decline to prosecute, notwithstanding that sufficient evidence may exist. Illustrative of the factors which the prosecutor may consider are reasonable doubt that the accused is in fact guilty, the extent of harm caused, the disproportionality of the punishment in relation to the offense or the offender, improper motives of a complainant, reluctance of the victim to testify, cooperation of the accused, and the likelihood of prosecution by another jurisdiction. In that list, the factor that stands out for me, given the facts that are before us, is the disproportionality of the punishment in relation to the offense or the offender. Now, as I read the district court's order, she was recognizing that, you know, despite the fact that there's evidence for the charge and the statute says that this is how it's supposed to be charged, the reality is we're going back 10 years, and if Mr. Umpress had been charged then, he would have been dealt with in juvenile delinquency court, likely would have had a stay of imposition there, at most would have been adjudicated delinquent, would not have faced a criminal conviction, would not have faced prison time. And simply because of the way the law is written, for this offense, which would have had those consequences 10 years ago, he now faces a presumptive sentence of 144 months in prison and an adult conviction as a sex offender. I know the law allows that. But the question is, does leaving the door open for a district court to grant a stay of adjudication apply to exceptional cases like these? Where you could have had the discretion to say, I'm not going to charge this because it seems to be an injustice, because if this would have been reported back when he was 14 or 15, the consequences would have been so significantly different.
Your Honor, I believe your question answers itself, because you said that's what the law requires in terms of having the case presented in district court for adults as compared to in juvenile court if the victim had reported it earlier and had been referred to law enforcement. And that's an issue that can be taken up with the legislature. The legislature has prohibited any...
I know the law requires that. My question is, but a prosecutor has the authority to not engage that law, to make a decision not to charge an offense, because as it would be under the charge, under the law in effect, it may raise some of these concerns that are listed in the ABA standards. So, I agree with you. That's what the law requires, but you're not required to charge the case.
And no, we're not.
We have to look at whether you clearly abused your discretion in charging this case, given the circumstances.
With the limited time I have left, I think it would be helpful to discuss the discretion that was exercised in this case and why it was exercised and why it's exercised differently in other cases in which the would-be defendant is accused of committing, you know, sexual misconduct or of extremely serious variety while they are in their teenage years and is not prosecuted until later. I mean, in this particular case, the record establishes that there were multiple victims that actually had reported similar abuse of the defendant, and that the abuse had been perpetrated against extremely young victims. Your Honor, I know that you mentioned one of those considerations from the ABA standards. Obviously, the state has to balance a whole host of considerations, including the risk to public safety, including the impact to the victim, including someone else's life who was irreparably changed by being sexually molested when she was 4 and 5 and 6 years old. And those are all things that were taken into account here. With all of that said, because of the delayed reporting and the fact that the defendant hypothetically could have received a different, you know, a trajectory if the case had been initially prosecuted in juvenile court, putting aside for the moment the fact that the state could have moved for certification and had the case presented as it would have ultimately gone to an adult track. But the state did take that into account. It chose to charge Mr. Umpress under subdivision 1G of the first degree criminal sexual conduct statute as compared to any of the other subdivisions. As this court knows, that subdivision allows a judge to much more easily stay the imposition or the stay the execution of the sentence if they were to find that a stay is in the best interest of the victim or and that a professional assessment indicates that the offender has been accepted into and can respond appropriately to a treatment program. That obviously is why that the offense that was charged in this case only carries a 10-year predatory offender registration requirement as opposed to the lifetime predatory offender registration requirement the district court was erroneously concerned about. And these are all things that were taken into account at the charging stage. And yes, my office does decline to charge cases which where there was delayed reporting and the defendant is now in the adult phase of his life as opposed to the juvenile when the offense happened. But taking all of these things into account, we made what we thought was an informed decision that took into account the dangers to the victim, the dangers to public safety, and the danger to other potential victims. And doing so is not a clear abuse of our ability to charge the cases that the people of Hennepin County elected us to do. I see that my time is out.
I have one question for you, though, before we move on to response argument. I note in the brief, and I think you've just mentioned it now, that there was an allegation against Mr. Umpress that he was engaged in this sort of conduct with another young victim, and that was reported back in 2008?
Yes, it was. There is, I don't want to stray from the record too much. I am privy to more information, as is every prosecutor in this state, that goes in the charging decision that does not
straying from the record, you've written in your brief that in 2008, it was reported that he had engaged in similar contact with another young female and that the case was not referred for delinquency action. It was referred instead to be dealt with in the child protection system.
It was declined to be charged.
It was declined to be charged.
The record establishes that.
Clarkin, can I impose upon our time just ask one additional question, Mr. Petras?
Yes, you may.
Fairly quick, I thought of this as you were giving that last summary answer, Mr. Petras. Is it possible that because we know the law, of course, and over the objection, and it says what it says, and yet we all also know, I don't think there's real dispute, that at a sentencing hearing where a stay of adjudication occurs, that is a dispositional resolution that otherwise for this law is always in the sole discretion of the judge. Now, my question to you is it possible that a clear abuse of discretion somehow can be considered when a prosecutor chooses, because we can all agree to disagree, but that's dispositional, to object to the court's stay of adjudication? In other words, we wouldn't be here if the state might disagree but didn't object. Is that a possible analysis?
I don't believe there's any basis in any case law or any statute that I'm aware of or that's been cited in the briefs for the position that the state would take at the sentencing phase or at the disposition phase to somehow establish that they clearly abused their charging function.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question, Judge?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Marvilli, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Paul Marvilli. I'm representing the respondent in this case, Mr. Angelo Umpress. And I would begin by saying that in this case, the circumstances that the district court was facing are, I think, quite apparently unique and exceptional, not just in terms of the conditions that existed at the time of the offense, but as I think more about it, all that's happened since then. The district court was facing a 27-year-old man who pled guilty to this offense without any promise about the outcome. And she looked at the life that he had lived since the time of this offense with no recidivism, no repeat of this very regrettable behavior that caused this incident and led to the charge. And I don't think I've seen a case like this, not just in stay of adjudication case law, but any case law where the offense happened half his life ago. And the district court asked the parties for input. She wanted to see why the prosecutor wouldn't agree to a stay of adjudication, and it was not forthcoming. The district court did not receive any input from the prosecutor about what the prosecutor had considered about Mr. Umphress himself. Indeed, in appellant's brief, it's noted, I believe, in footnote 12, that the state's position on this is that they didn't have the information. In the PSI, the sentencing report, and the psychosexual report. Because the state's position here has been steadfastly that the only discretion of the prosecutor that is subject to review by a court is the decision to charge. Yet the prosecutor, again, appellant in his own brief on page 24, note 16, says that the factors involved in the decision to charge are not subject to review by a district court. And that's not a matter of law so much as it is just a matter of the record. There's nothing in the record for a judge to review about a prosecutor's decision to charge. So the district court has to concern herself with the prosecutor's treatment of the charge once it's been issued. And this is why, in my brief, I argued, based on Supreme Court authority, that the charging function is not simply the decision to charge. It's how the prosecutor deals with the charge once he issues it. Every practicing attorney knows that prosecutors offer to dismiss charges during plea bargaining in exchange for a plea to one or two others all the time. In rarer instances, prosecutors threaten to bring more charges during plea bargaining, exercising their charging authority to get a plea outcome that they want. Now, the district court, in its order, both on the record and in its written order, described her decision as based on a clear abuse of prosecutorial discretion in the charging function. And as I was able to research this issue, I saw very clearly that what the district court could not reconcile was the prosecutor's need, the obligation the prosecutor had to factor in at least the PSI and the PSR, which can only happen after the charge is issued. The charging function continues. The decision whether to retain a charge is just as much implicates the decision to charge as what went into issuing the charge in the first place. Now, I don't know if this issue has been raised before. I had not seen that it was, but I felt that given what the court has already pointed out in this argument, that there doesn't seem to be anything in the case law, not in State v. Foss, not in State v. Lee, about what an actual abuse of the charging function is. You know, I simply looked up charging function, and that's what brought me to State v. Strife and State v. Hart. And they both describe, I think, matter-of-factly, pointing out that when it comes to the decision to charge and then the plea bargaining process, that's the side of the spectrum where almost all of the discretion resides with the prosecutor. So the discretion up until the decision by the court here to give the stay of adjudication must have involved how the prosecutor dealt with the plea bargaining situation. I've cited a couple of major cases, State v. Anderson and Beeman v. State, which describe how a prosecutor is obligated, and uniquely so in our justice system, to consider the nature of the offender. Is it an incorrigible adult, or is it a first-time juvenile offender? A case which cites the need for a prosecutor to consider the offender's mental capacity. And as I looked at the PSI in this case and saw the environment that Mr. Umphress grew up in, his exposure to sexual abuse of himself and others by adults who should have known better, the gang violence, the guns and the drugs, the dead body in his house, the lack of anybody there to tell him that what we're doing is wrong. And yet, as it's noted in the PSI, the probation officer found out that the moment when Mr. Umphress was caught engaging in this activity by his mother, he stopped and he ceased doing it. There's nothing anywhere showing that he ever engaged in this activity again. In other words, all he needed was an adult to say that's not right. And it seems to me that ever since this offense, the life that Mr. Umphress has led has been in recognition that that wasn't right. He's built a life for himself where he's been able to stay employed. He's battled depression, had suicidal thoughts. He's been to therapy. He engages in exercise. He's able to keep a job. He has a son, and by all accounts, he's a good father. In other words, if this case had been treated in the juvenile court back in when it happened 13 years ago, where Mr. Umphress is right now is exactly where a court would want him to be. He dealt with it and he left it behind him. So I think what the district court was wondering as she considered what decision to make here from the time the plea was entered in January of last year until until the end of April when she ordered the stay of adjudication was, what were the prosecutor's objections?
Mr. Kirby, on that issue, am I correct in understanding that the state offered a plea agreement that would result in a stay of imposition and your client rejected that? And then am I also correct in understanding that even after that, at the sentencing, the state urged the district court to stay imposition? Am I correct in that understanding that procedural history?
That is correct, Your Honor.
If we're evaluating the prosecutor's discretion in its position presented to the district court in both plea negotiations and at sentencing, the differences between a stay of imposition and a stay of adjudication, those were the choices have been narrowed to those two options, correct?
Yes, though if I may, Your Honor, point out, as I did in my brief, that a stay of imposition does not implicate a prosecutor's charging function and discretion. A stay of imposition is post-conviction, and the discretion about whether to impose a stay of imposition resides exclusively with the court. So that is not a matter where the prosecutor's discretion is implicated. But going back all the way to Kratzer and Foss, and as the district court noted in her decision, a stay of adjudication, and she quoted Foss, is more akin to a pretrial order.
It seems to me, I did read that argument in your brief. It seems to me that you sort of want it both ways, I guess. You want to review the district court's charging decision, but you don't want the prosecutor to present any evidence or argument about its subsequent decisions after charging. Is that your position?
I am not quite tracking with the phrasing, Your Honor. I would, in your question, I would note that I did address it in my brief at page 36, pointing out that a stay of imposition is not an exercise of the charging discretion. And what I wanted, Your Honor, was, see, I don't believe that the argument I'm presenting here imposes some kind of new, unprecedented and challenging burden for the prosecutor. I think all it would have taken was for the prosecutor to couple his objection to the stay of adjudication with anything at all that he had considered about Mr. Umphress. See, those considerations about Mr. Umphress are just as relevant and applicable to a court's decision on whether to give a stay of imposition. But they are necessarily implicated in a prosecutor's refusal to agree to a stay of adjudication because that is a pre-adjudicatory decision. So I respectfully disagree that I'm trying to have it both ways here, Your Honor. I'm recognizing there is a bifurcation involved here in the judicial process, which Strife and Hart also both recognized, that up until the time a conviction is recorded, either by plea or jury, the discretion resides with the prosecutor, so he must display it. And in my brief, I cited the very recent decision by this court in Back v. State, and then a previous decision, State v. Dela Cruz, where it's been recognized that a district court's failure to exercise the discretion accorded to it is an abuse of discretion. So,
Mr. Bigley, can I ask you, is it possible, what's obviously so different and unique for this judge and these facts and for the parties was precisely the statute that Mr. Petras is referring to. So the legislature is anticipating a scenario to some extent of what we have here, where a decade or so from the crime to the sentencing phase. And my question is that the sort of issue that gets where normally we don't look at criminal history? What we are looking at, and I think you're arguing and the judge was trying to consider, is this man before her, the same person who committed a crime way back when it was committed and he admitted to it. Does that make the sort of a new unique scenario that goes to the discretion a prosecutor should exercise, obviously, is that's what makes this different. But if that's the case, how do we still measure it as to a clear abuse?
Well, my position remains that there was no exercise of discretion by the prosecutor in refusing the stay of adjudication agreement, that the failure to exercise any discretion whatsoever about Mr. Umphress is what can constitute that abuse. I agree that statute and the considerations that are provided by it can and should be a factor. I think the district court was clearly wrestling with that, as she stated in her decision, that if this case had been dealt with 13 years ago, we wouldn't be in this position. And the prosecutor is not willing to accept anything less than a full conviction. But I think when you consider what the district court did here, okay, and noting again that Mr. Umphress pled guilty without any promises, nothing impeded that. The prosecutor got their plea. And the district court then gave him 5 years probation. He is expected to engage in sex offender treatment and counseling. In other words, virtually all the conditions that would accompany the recording of the plea for a conviction are here. If there is a significant enough violation, this plea will be recorded as a conviction automatically. The degree of difference involved here is so minute and scant that the prosecutor needed to have something from the prosecution. I'm sorry, the district court needed to have something from the prosecution to tip the needle over towards registering this as a conviction. But all that the prosecutor provided were statements about public safety and the crime that was committed against the victim, which are certainly legitimate factors. They enter into every case, especially one like this. But the district court could already look at this offender and see that public safety hadn't been a factor with this person for over a decade.
Mr. Maravilli, I have one more question, if the presiding judge will allow. In the Lee opinion, Justice Page wrote a separate opinion where he said that Crotzer had effectively been overruled. Do you agree with that statement?
I do, if I can explain why. I think it's because the problem with Crotzer was the Supreme Court wrote that a stay of adjudication could be ordered either because of a clear abuse of discretion in the charging function or special circumstances. Lee made finally very clear in 2005 that there must be a finding of clear abuse of discretion by the prosecutor anytime this issue comes up. It can't be either or. So that is how I believe I tailored my argument to show how there was no discretion exercised towards this unique, particular person charged with this case over half his life after it was committed when he was a juvenile. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Petras, it's your turn for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Larkin. I understand what Mr. Maiorvelli wants in terms of the trial prosecutor to have specifically addressed a reason that a stay of adjudication was not appropriate at the sentencing hearing in this case. But there's nothing in the law that supports such a requirement. And rather than the De La Cruz—
Mr. Petras, I have a couple of questions. Is there anything in the record that indicates Mr. Umphress threatened the victim so she didn't disclose earlier or did anything to cover it up? I mean, we often have cases like this where there are threats made to the victims of sexual offenses, especially against children, to prevent them from disclosing. Is there any evidence in the record suggesting those were the circumstances here?
Again, the victim was between 4 and 6 years old at the time of the repeated sexual abuse in this case. And so when she was able to get the courage up to begin reporting it to people and had to report it multiple times to family members and different family members before it was ultimately referred to the police and things started happening, I don't believe she was able to recall 10 years earlier whether there was or whether there wasn't any type of pressure from Mr. Umphress about whether she should say
anything. So the record doesn't reflect that there was any type of pressure is the answer to my question.
It's silent on that issue.
Silent. What does the record tell us to indicate that 13 years later, Mr. Umphress poses a threat to public safety?
The fact that at one point in his life, he repeatedly sexually abused a 4 to 6 year old girl when he was 10 years older than her. That is something that any prosecutor in this state would take into account as affecting public safety. And I understand—
Is
many
there anything
years
in the record that indicates he engaged in any behavior of that type after the age of 15 or 16, the charge period?
I believe those cases were declined.
Okay, so there were opportunities to charge him with this sort of behavior, but the cases were declined?
My office exercised its discretion, yes.
So I'm having a hard time understanding why we need to go forward with this charge because he's a danger to the public based on what he did 13 years ago, even though there were other referrals to your office at that time and charges were declined. I'm just having a hard time reconciling that.
And that's not the prerogative of the court, with all due respect, Judge Larkin. That is the separation of powers that exists and is the prosecutor's role to choose which charges to put forth. And there may not be sufficient evidence, and that is the court's responsibility to point out. There may be other considerations, but this was not a clear abuse of the prosecutorial charging function to go forward.
Mr. Petras, don't take offense. I'm in a position where the Supreme Court has told us that in determining whether we should reverse or affirm here, we have to determine de novo whether there was a clear abuse of prosecutorial charging discretion. I'm having a difficult time understanding how a judge is supposed to do that if a judge is not at all allowed to inquire into the circumstances that resulted in the charging decision. I respect your position that you don't have to answer any of these questions and you don't have to explain your decision. But then that puts us in a position where you're saying your decision is beyond review. And that seems to me inconsistent with what the Supreme Court has said, which is the door is open to be used sparingly if there's a clear abuse of prosecutorial discretion. Now, when we apply the abuse of discretion standard to a district court judge's decision, we look at what the judge decided, why he decided it. Did he follow the law? Did he follow the law correctly? So I'm simply trying to use the accepted manner of reviewing an exercise of discretion in this context, which the Supreme Court has suggested we should do. Now, perhaps the Supreme Court on further review wants to say, none of this is up for second guessing. You can't evaluate a prosecutor's charging decision. They may do that. That would be a significant change from the standard they've set forth at this point. So please don't take offense. I'm not calling into question your integrity. I'm just trying to get some information so I can do what the Supreme Court has told us we must do, which is determine whether there was a clear abuse of charging authority.
In this case, the mitigating circumstances that the judge pointed to for justifying the clear abuse of prosecutorial charging function directly are contradicted by this court's own precedential case law. I cannot be more clear that affirming what the district court did in this case will require this court to overturn its own controlling decisions in Lemming and Ort and to create a giant split in the case law.
And why will it require us to overturn those decisions?
Because they specifically said that mitigating circumstances, such as a lack of criminal record since an offense occurred, or other mitigating circumstances that would apply at sentencing and justified in this particular case, the state's decision to agree to a stay of imposition.
Mr. Petras, on those cases, though, just to clarify, and this is part of why I asked Mr. Maravigli the same question, this is a very unique statute in which it almost seems the legislature has opened a huge door to consider the sort of mitigating factors you wouldn't in any other case, because he has now lived a life we can look at since then, where normally, and in those cases, obviously, while there might be some short-term redemption and acceptance of a plea, there's no time between a crime and sentencing to do with this individual. Doesn't that make this a bit, it can't be looked at in the same lens as our traditional cases when considering the clear abuse of discretion?
I would implore this court to read Judge Johnson's decision in the Paris case that I reference in my brief, which specifically addresses Minnesota statute section 260B.193 subdivision 5D, the statute that we're discussing today. It was an equal protection discussion, but it explained very clearly why the legislature made the decision that it did and why people who are prosecuted for crimes that are committed in their juveniles versus people who are prosecuted for those same crimes committed as the juveniles but in district court are not similarly situated. I believe, but Judge Slater, that will address the concerns.
Mr. Petras, does that necessarily compel the conclusion that every circumstance that falls under that statute justifies a charge? Or does a prosecutor have discretion to say, given the circumstances, given the passage of time, given the allegations, I'm not going to charge this case? Because, you know, if it would have been charged when he was 14, I mean, I appreciate you say you could have moved for certification. I find that certification on this case in 2008 would have been extremely unlikely based on my 13 years of practicing in Hennepin County, which ended about that time in juvenile court. So, I mean, I think what would have happened was a juvenile delinquency proceeding, maybe a stay of adjudication, maybe not, but the importance of that would have been he would not have ended up with an adult felony criminal conviction. He would have had to register. He would have had to go to sex offender treatment. He would have perhaps been placed out of home, but he wouldn't face prison and an adult conviction. And now he faces adult conviction, 144 months in prison, not because of anything he did, but simply because there was a delayed report. It doesn't excuse his behavior years ago, but it puts him in a very different position. And I don't know if it's unreasonable to ask whether that new position is unjust given the circumstances. And that's where the discretion comes in.
May I answer, Your Honor?
Yes.
I responding both to what you just said, Judge Larkin, as well as to a previous question that you made. I believe that district courts, like prosecutors, have discretion in different areas. A line of cases that I would point this court to, as opposed to the De La Cruz and the Back decisions that Mr. Maravigli referenced, would be about when a defendant requests a downward departure at sentencing from the sentencing guidelines. Obviously, the law could not be clear that a district court properly exercises its discretions if it listens to the information and then makes a decision consistent with the guidelines without having to specifically express on the record the reasons that it's going along with the guidelines. Similarly, the prosecutor in this case did not clearly abuse his discretion in the prosecutorial charging function by taking in information, choosing to charge a case, offering a substantial downward durational and dispositional departure from the sentencing guidelines to a stay of imposition on this case. There is no clear abuse in what the prosecutor did in choosing to charge and the position that it ultimately took with respect to sentencing. I am very much out of time. I am more than happy to answer any other questions this court has.
No, I Don't see any additional questions, so that will conclude the hearing. Thank you both for your briefing, your arguments, and your answers to our questions this morning. The case is submitted.
Thank you.